uncertain strategic issues don't fit into the linear world of the 3 to 5 year plan. Even if the dynamics in the strategy room were perfect, the world doesn't unfold in nice, neat annual increments. Things change all the time, both in your business and in the markets around you. Potential deals do not occur when you have your annual board strategy session. They occur when they occur, and you need to be ready. Why not discuss some of the key strategic questions and performance every week, or month at a minimum, complementing traditional annual strategic planning processes? Strategy as a journey. Hold regular strategy dialogues instead of just an annual process. Track your portfolio of initiatives across multiple horizons and update your strategy based on progress. Monitor a 3 years back, 3 years forward rolling plan if you want to track numbers. Hold regular strategy dialogues. Say you trimmed your annual process to the bare minimum. We can almost hear many of you and your managers sighing with relief. Instead, you launch more regular, incisive strategy conversations with your team, perhaps as a fixed space on your monthly management team meeting. You start maintaining a live list of the most important strategic issues, a list of your big moves, and a pipeline of initiatives for executing them. You would get a lot closer to achieving continuous engagement on strategy. Every time you meet as a team, you update each other quickly on the state of the market and your business, then reflect on your issues, big moves, and initiatives. You consider whether they remain appropriate, should be modified, or should be stopped. Every time you meet, you also do a deep dive into one or a few topics of opportunity or concern. Track your portfolio of initiatives. Your strategy will evolve like a pipeline of initiatives working through different stage gates. Long-dated and prospective ideas will be like real options where the critical path is about learning and achieving familiarity. For initiatives that are about scaling growth in a 3-year horizon, the emphasis will be on managing capital investments, achieving milestones, and showing strong user acceptance. For initiatives that are short-term and in highly familiar territory, you will be looking at in-year financial delivery. The pipeline should have movement in it too. It's designed to flow over time rather than be a set-and-forget plan. Your team will never need to write again a 150-page deck that is the basis for so much social gaming and manipulation. You won't need to wait a year to see that the hockey stick was just going to be another hair on the back. People will know that they will be continually accountable, so they will be less likely to sandbag or make bold claims in a bid for resources. Even if they do continue the traditional behavior, the offenses will become apparent a lot sooner and will be easier to catch. Those false hockey sticks will mostly go away. They happen because of the disconnected dynamic between the 5-year strategy and the 1-year operating plan. But those now become rolling plans. Because you are constantly staying on top of what is happening and why around your big moves, you will have a much better sense for what is truly causing success and failure. No more success is because of management excellence and failure is due to one-off external events. Monitor a rolling plan. This continuous approach leaves the question of how you get to a plan and a budget from these monthly conversations. You may continue a bare-bones annual process, but more likely, you will move to a rolling 12-month plan that you update as needed. You might also have a 2 to 10 year plan on stage all the time in the strategy sessions that you adjust if you change initiatives, priorities, and big moves. Every big move leads to an update of the expected trajectory of the business. You are moving all the time, just like the world around you. The strategy process will be less formulaic and more adapted to the needs of businesses at any given point. It will be a journey of almost continuous checks of whether the assumptions made in the strategy still hold, whether the strategy needs a refresh, or whether the context has moved so much that new strategies are required. The strategy process will be a journey that meanders dynamically through the corporation, helping to navigate highly competitive industries and fast-moving trends. Tencent, for one, has a highly adaptable strategy process that can react immediately to changes in the marketplace. They're making, in some years, hundreds of acquisitions, so they're constantly adapting and changing and moving based on new information. Tencent has a broad strategic direction toward developing their platform and new elements of the platform. But the fundamentals, the big moves, change as a result of a continuing dialogue among the management team and in reaction to changes in their business context. 2. From getting to yes to debating real alternatives. Most planning discussions bring one plan into the room. Success is seen as approving that singular plan. Then we all can go home and be happy. The most annoying thing that can happen then is for someone to question the premise of the plan or to open up the solution space and bring different options into the room. But of course, we all know that this deeper reflection is exactly what is needed to get to real strategies. Think of it this way. Real strategy is about making your hard-to-reverse choices about how to win. Planning is about how to make those choices happen. But the first step is being skipped too often, even if we try to make ourselves feel okay by labeling the plan strategic. There's simply no point in precisely planning for the wrong future. Discussing real alternatives. Frame strategy around hard-to-reverse choices. Calibrate aspirations against your endowment, trends, and moves to bring an outside view into the room. Compare real alternative plans with different risk and investment profiles. Track assumptions over time and build contingencies into your plans so you can evolve your choices as you learn more. Use de-biasing techniques to ensure quality decision-making. Frame strategy as choices. What if your strategy decisions looked like this picture in Exhibit 30? This would be very different than signing off on another plan. By reframing the strategy discussion as a choice-making rather than a plan-making exercise, the whole conversation will change. To build your own strategy decision grid, identify the major axes of choice. They have to be hard-to-reverse choices. Think of them as the things the next management team will have to take as a given. Then, for each choice dimension, describe 3 to 5 possible but different choices. The overall strategic options will be the few coherent bundles of these choices. Focus your debate and your analysis on the few most difficult choices. Calibrate your strategy. What if every strategy document had a version of the analysis of endowment, trends, and moves that we've laid out and included an odds score, describing the chances of moving up the power curve? Now, wouldn't that reframe the conversations? You wouldn't just run through the decks and be led to a yes. You'd see that many traditional approaches to strategy won't work. You'd have to go back to square one and try again. You'd have to consider real alternatives that likely lead you to bigger moves than you've made in the past. In a world where we are just focused on getting to yes, plans can end up being discussed in a vortex with no reliable calibration. Now, based on what we've explained about the empirics of strategy, you can test a strategy with real facts. Explicitly using the outside view about your aspirations and big moves can help you overcome some of the biases that let the social side bog down the discussions in the strategy room. You get the opportunity to move away from those 150-page decks that are designed to create diversions and numb the audience into saying yes to the proposal. Even staying put on the power curve is often a lot of hard work, and most management teams and their leaders don't want to just stay put. They want to push the envelope to stretch themselves. The problem is that hard work and pushing the envelope have very little to do with the real issue, moving on the power curve. Moves on the power curve are relative to competition, and guess what? Your competitors are pushing the envelope too. Of course they are. We often hear teams complain about their CEOs overloading them with initiatives. The question is, which are the right big moves that can realistically get you ahead of your competition? Those initiatives should get all your attention, should absorb all your efforts. Remember that boardroom across town, where your competitor is discussing how they're going to grow their market share, just like you are. When Bill Gates was CEO of Microsoft in the 1990s, he spent as much as half of product review sessions interrogating developers about what they were hearing about competing products and about what, theoretically, others could do that would get in the way of Microsoft's plans. That focus on the competition certainly worked for him, and it can work for you. Compare alternative plans. We can already hear you thinking, great, more data. Isn't that just an invitation for the next game of getting to a yes? Maybe. But you can try to avoid the problem by forcing a discussion around strategic alternatives that management believes to be at similar risk-return levels, instead of a single big move. Then force the discussion on which big move to make. Or show different plan scenarios with different levels of resourcing and risk so you can make real, quantified trade-offs rather than being forced to make all-or-nothing choices. Track assumptions over time. A few short weeks after the plan is developed, the detailed assumptions go into a fog of memory. The variance of budget gets tracked very carefully, but the underlying assumptions, such as uptake rates, market growth, and inflation rates, are not tracked as carefully. Imagine if there was an assumptions budget that was tracked as carefully as the financial budget. Come approval time, we love concrete plans. But as the real world plays out with all its uncertainty, we come to hate the rigidity. Let's stop planning as though we know the future. Rather, decide what you can today with the information you have and build explicit trigger points into the strategy to make better decisions as you learn more. Running strategy as a journey, Shift 1, will enable this. De-biased decision-making. Warren Buffett is said to operate with red and blue teams, even at times hiring two investment banking teams to evaluate a possible acquisition. One argues in favor, the other against. Both are offered success fees, payable only if Buffett decides that their argument wins. Private equity firms have found that more than 30% of decisions are different when opposing possibilities are pitted against each other. That is a big deal. There are, of course, many other de-biasing techniques. One we regularly use is a pre-mortem, where you assume a strategy has failed to achieve its intended objective after, say, 2 years. Then you brainstorm as a team what caused the failure and how it might have been avoided. This safely gets many big issues out on the table. This is where your qualities as a business leader can have tremendous impact on the trajectory of your company. Give yourself a break. End the nauseatingly boring and paralyzing pseudo-strategy discussions that, in reality, are purely about getting to yes. Instead, give your team and yourself a chance to debate your real choices. 3. From peanut butter to picking your 1 in 10s. Peanut butter is the biggest enemy of big moves. It is near impossible to make big moves if resources are peanut buttered across all businesses and operations. Our data show that you are far more likely to make a major move up the power curve because one or two businesses let you break out, rather than because every business or operation improved in lockstep. To move, you have to identify the breakout opportunities as early as possible and feed them all the resources they need. That means getting your team to align behind the likely winners, and that's where the problem usually starts. Despite the best intentions, peanut butter seeps back into the process. Intellectually, it's actually easier than you might think to identify the likely winners in your portfolio. If you were to ask your management team to identify the most likely winners in the portfolio, they will probably strongly agree on number 1 and maybe number 2, much less so on, say, what ranks number 7 or 8. We have done exercises with dozens of management teams and rarely found that picking your 1 in 10s is hard. That's really not the issue. The problems start when the discussion moves to resource allocation, because that's where the social side of strategy kicks in. Some industries seem to intuitively grasp that you have to kiss a lot of frogs before you find the prince. In fashion, people understand that the one hit out of 10 is what matters. The same is true in movies, oil exploration, venture capital, and some others. But most other businesses do not have a hit mentality, or in other words, they lack appreciation for probabilities. Picking your 1 in 10s. Adjust incentives so the team supports the resource reallocation. Pick where to compete on a granular level, maybe even by vote. Allocate resources from a portfolio level view and skew toward opportunity. Play to win. Allocate enough resources to outcompete others in the key areas. Adjust incentives to encourage resource reallocation. To move away from peanut buttering resources, you will need to explicitly address the motivation of the team and structure both performance management and incentives accordingly. If some people are taking a bullet for the team, they need to know why and what's in it for them. In our experience, it does take considerable leadership to get everyone to line up behind skewing resource allocations, but just having the conversation about the 1 in 10 starts to reset expectations and change the nature of the dialogue. Pick where to compete at a granular level. One thing that really gets in the way of dynamic resource reallocation is excessive aggregation and averaging. You can't see the true variance of opportunity when things get rolled up into big profit centers. Instead, develop more granular opportunity maps with at least 30 to 100 cells, then decide where to move resources. By the way, this 1 in 10 idea is a sort of fractal. It applies at every level of a company, where managers should identify their most likely candidates to break out and should pour resources into them. We've seen many senior teams move away from peanut buttering by using some form of voting to pick priorities. In some cases, that's a secret ballot in envelopes. In other cases, CEOs set up a grand matrix showing all the opportunity cells and let executives allocate points to the various initiatives by applying stickers to the matrix. Whatever the approach, we find that most of the time there is strong agreement on what the very best opportunities are. The same holds true, by the way, for agreeing on what the likely duds are. Not hard at all. It's the broad middle where views diverge and resources get squandered. Allocate resources at a portfolio level. Just because you are organized one way doesn't mean that is the only way you should look at the market. In fact, if resources are allocated in too much of a trickle-down fashion as they move down the company hierarchy, you will never get the radical kind of resource shift you need. Studies have shown that resource allocation decisions change a lot when a company's structure shifts, even though nothing else gets changed. One of us recently completed a study for a client where instead of rolling up plants at a business unit level, we went one level down. We built the detailed curve of the 60 or so specific investable opportunities they had, irrespective of which business they came from. The result? A much bigger shift in resources to the best opportunities that tended to get averaged out in a more democratic process. We've also seen how founder owners often keep all major decisions to themselves. There's no incentive then to peanut butter resources. They often survey executives to get input on where to invest, but make the decisions on their own. They are much nimbler in deploying resources decisively to the most promising initiatives. We view them as exemplary for how business leaders should go about finishing off the peanut butter process. Play to win. Now that you have a granular view and are making resource allocation decisions at a portfolio level, the next step is to truly distort resources so you can win. Don't just look at the resources relative to your other opportunities. Remember that big moves have to be big versus the world. So you have to base your decisions on what the best competitors are doing. That may mean radical change. 4. From approving budgets to making big moves. We've discussed how the social side of strategy can make the 3-year plan a cover for the real game, negotiating year one, which becomes the budget. Managers tend to be interested in years two and three, but absolutely fascinated by year one because that is where they live and die. So we need a shift to end the situation where the strategy is little more than the opening act to the budget. One of the worst culprits in these budget-driven discussions is the base case, some version of a planned business case anchored in a number of largely opaque assumptions about the context and the company strategy. The base case is rarely anchored in a firm understanding of actual business performance. It's more like a drift anchor, a reference point that floats among context and assumptions, with last year being the only real reference point. The base case is the manifestation of the inside view in the strategy discussion. Why is that a problem? Well, for one, the base case may obscure the view of where the business actually stands, which makes it hard to see what realistic aspirations should be, and certainly what strategic moves could deliver on those aspirations. Many budgets and plans we see have gaps in them, portions of the projection that don't have a rationale attached to them. These gaps are often classified as business as usual, things managers promise to deliver as part of leading their organizations. The managers request resources for operating expenses and people that can only be justified by closing these gaps, but it's largely unclear how that's supposed to happen, and the actions executed under business as usual typically do nothing to help a unit or the whole business make big moves. Aren't discussions about targets a drag? Imagine if you could turn these discussions on their head. What if, instead of forcing decisions on targets and making uncertain promises, you could focus the strategy dialogue on big moves, on your best ideas for how to beat the market? Then just let the outcomes follow. Making big moves. Build a momentum case instead of a base case. Do a teardown of past results to see what came from trends and what came from moves. Mind the gap. Check that the plan is big enough to fill the gap between the momentum line and the aspiration. Benchmark the big moves relative to competition to test that they are big enough to really move the needle. Separate the discussion on moves from the discussion on budgets. One should follow the other. Build a momentum case. A practical way to avoid this trap is to forget the base case. Instead, although this can be a bit awkward, challenge yourself and the people working on your strategy to build a proper momentum case. This is a simple version of the future that presumes that the trajectory of a business's current performance is going to continue as it has over the preceding period. The momentum case discards presumptions about new and miraculous market share gains and ignores all claims of productivity improvements. The momentum case essentially strips down the business plan to its bare minimum of just continuing the current business momentum, the highly probable trajectory without any additional actions. Anchoring in the momentum case will already help you avoid the first causes of unrealistic hockey sticks and hairy backs. You'll have a better sense of how far you really need to go, rather than just assuming the progress that invariably shows up in the base case. You'll see how much impact your big moves need to deliver to change the trajectory of the business. Without a well-documented momentum case, it's hard to sort fact from fiction in your strategy discussion. Do a teardown of your results. Even with the momentum case, you still have to absolutely understand and be explicit about why your business is making money today. That knowledge lets you take the bias out of decisions about what risks to take and about managerial performance and rewards. Not being clear about what actually drives performance lets the social side of strategy rear its ugly head and causes many flawed strategies. Think about the BU head who managed to bring the business to break even in a very tough competitive context versus the BU head who generates huge profits in a virtually monopolistic situation. Who will be better rewarded in most incentive discussions? And how will that affect the way people think about strategy and behave in the strategy room? It's actually not that hard to perform a teardown. The momentum case is typically a much tougher exercise. In a teardown, You just take the business's past performance and build a bridge, that is, isolate the different contributions that explain the changes in performance. This is something most CFOs do regularly for factors like forex changes and inflation. The bridge needs to consider average industry performance and growth, the impact of submarket selection, and the effect of M&A. Mind the gap. Now that you have a thorough, unbiased understanding of where your business stands and what drives performance, you can calibrate your aspirations. Then, most importantly, you can size up just how big your moves need to be to close the gap between the momentum case and the aspiration. You will see the full size of the task ahead, not assuming some stuff as business as usual, but tallying up all the work the enterprise needs to do to diverge from the momentum case. Nothing wrong with a big gap between momentum and aspiration if you have the big moves to fill it up. Let's upend this disappointing dynamic about targets in the strategy room. Don't just ask for a target or a budget. Also ask for the 20 things each of your business leaders wants to do to produce a series of big moves over the coming period. Then debate the big moves rather than the numbers that are supposed to result from these moves. Why should we do this big move? Why shouldn't we? How does the company look different depending on what risk and resource threshold we set for the big moves? A shift in focus on moves will also bring into the strategy room some discussions that, as we've shown, are very important, but that don't often make it into the conversation. M&A is one of the big moves you can make, but is often treated as a separate track. Productivity and differentiation, two of the other five big moves, are typically treated as part of an operational performance review, even though, as we've seen, they're strategic differentiators. M&A, productivity, and differentiation all need to be discussed explicitly as part of strategy discussions, not in terms of numerical targets, but in terms of how you can turn them into big moves, into gaining advantage over your competitors. Benchmark the moves. Instead of the standard 150-page set of details, ask each manager for a set of big moves calibrated against what the competition has been doing and is expected to do. If a business leader requests additional resources, you approve them based on whether or not you believe the big moves she is proposing could lead to a real hockey stick and whether you trust her to pull them off. If the plan does not include big moves, then targets and resources get lowered. Budgets are not tied to targets. Budgets are tied to big moves. Talk about moves first, budgets second. This focus on big moves will get away from the incrementalism that comes with the normal process. Last year we did X, so this year we can probably do X plus a little. You also get away from the risk aversion that comes with the normal process, which treats every issue at the same time. With this shift, the big moves come first. The consideration of risks, while obviously important, comes later. Everybody will know that if they do not have big moves and cannot instill confidence about pulling off big moves, they will lose resources accordingly. Here is your chance to cut through the social side of strategy and dispense once and for all with the largely fact-free advice written in most business books about strategy. If you want to put strategy back into the strategy room, just evolve the strategy dialogue around big moves based on facts, calibrated against competition, and informed by your experience and judgment. 5. From budget inertia to liquid resources. Let's assume decisions are made all around big moves. How do we avoid an unpleasant awakening? Let's say it's budget time in late October, and we want to make a big move, allocating 15% of all CapEx and OpEx across our businesses to new growth opportunities. But oops, nothing happens. Why? Well, we don't have the resources. We can't just pull out 10 to 20% of the OpEx budget of a fully running business without warning. Nobody could do that responsibly. To mobilize resources and budgets, there needs to be a certain level of resource liquidity. Most businesses do not create resource liquidity up front, but resource liquidity is, in essence, the currency of strategy. How can you make a strategic bet if you don't have any resources to put on the table? We believe that the handover between strategy and execution happens when the resources are made available to follow through on big moves. Execution can then begin, and managers can be held accountable. They no longer have the excuse of resource constraints. Liquid resources. Start freeing up resources as much as a year before your strategy will need to deploy them. Move to 80% based budgeting to unlock a kitty of contestable resources. Charge managers an opportunity cost for their resources so they have an incentive to free them up. Free up resources beforehand. You need to get started early, on January 1st or whenever your fiscal year begins. That's when serious productivity improvement initiatives need to be underway to free resources by the time resource allocations will be decided later in the year. Resources can be freed in many other ways too, through divestitures, capital injections, etc. The reason why we highlight productivity is that strategic resources are not just about cash. OpEx and talent are often equal, if not more important, resources that need to be freed to be reallocated. Then you need determination. If you want resources to be available to be reallocated, you need to hold on to them after they have been freed. If there were physical laws in business, one of the strongest would be that all resources dissipate instantly. Your R&D organization will have the most creative new product ideas as soon as an engineer has time. A sales force will identify the most attractive new business opportunities as soon as the productivity program has freed a part of the sales force. Being incredibly clear about separating the initiatives that free resources from the opportunities to reinvest them is foundational to any meaningful productivity gain and for holding on to resources that you intend to reallocate. Make an 80% based budget. You might have heard of zero-based budgets, the idea that every single dollar should be put in the docks and earned on merits. It's a nice idea, and will make a lot of sense in specific times and situations, but you can't run an operation 1 year at a time, and you can't hire and fire an entire workforce every year. What you can do is force a certain sliver of the budget to be contestable every year. Here we say 20% just as a marker. In some cases, 10% might be more realistic. The point is to force money back into the pot every year, freeing it for reallocation. Remember, to reallocate, you need to deallocate. A related idea is to set high targets for improvement, which are distinct from growth goals, to generate a continual kitty of resources. Rather than just delivering their numbers, leaders in a business are tasked with freeing up a certain percentage of resources via productivity on the base business, as well as continually delivering on new growth initiatives. Place an opportunity cost on resources. One common problem is that resources can be thought of as free if they don't directly hit your specific budget. For example, in many retailers, the category managers are tasked with driving sales and gross margins in their categories. Yet the scarce resources need to deliver those gains, the limited shelf space and costly inventory, are often not measured as hard. As a result, category managers don't want to give up space or cut back on inventory, even though doing so would free up resources for other opportunities. In the retail case, the answer is pretty simple. Use ratios. If the category manager is measured on sales per square foot, return on space, and stock turns, return on inventory, then the incentives to release resources to more productive uses are stronger. In other cases, the solutions may be more complex, but nonetheless need to be found to make sure that resources are allocated as effectively as possible. Without continual freeing of resources, strategy becomes a paper exercise constrained by a limited budget. That doesn't work in a world where big moves are required. As you create resource liquidity, you breathe fresh air into the strategy room. Big moves become possible. NXP had 14 businesses when they spun off from Philips. Over time, NXP moved all its resources to two businesses and freed cash and people from all the others. These 1 in 10 choices in automotive and identification, backed by full resource shifts, were big moves that created a winning streak for NXP. The likely movers were resourced to win. 6. From sandbagging to open risk portfolios. When BUs develop strategic plans, as we all know, they sandbag their targets. As you aggregate these plans on a corporate level, the buffers add up to a corporate sandbag that makes the hairy back virtually a certainty. Because of risk avoidance, you don't have goals set and resources allocated in ways that allow for a breakout performance. The mechanism of aggregating BU strategies also explains why we see so few big moves proposed at the corporate level. Many M&A initiatives and other bold programs are simply viewed as too risky by individual BU heads. These initiatives never make the final list that they bring into the strategy room. Sandbagging is, we admit, a complex problem that is hard to untangle. Let's say a leadership team of a business unit plans for margin improvement, perhaps 10% of sales. The leader doesn't want to overcommit, so he corrects for risk and promises only to deliver 5 points. Then he thinks, if I have 5 points free, I will invest in good growth ideas. He winds up with a lot of flexibility, a sandbag. If margin does not improve, he has a risk buffer. But he may give up on the attempt to pursue margin improvement beyond the 5 points he's promised. He also may be taking on considerable risk to invest in growth, the effects of which will only be noticed later. But we have also seen teams make strides against sandbagging. The fundamental idea is to move away from the current dynamic of sandbag the budget, hockey stick the strategy, to a situation where risks and investments are managed on an aggregate level. Put differently, the idea is to move from aggregating lots of individual budget sandbags together from the bottom up and to creating a single corporate-level view. Move from hockey sticks everywhere to one corporate-level hockey stick that's based on a series of plausible big moves. We all naturally tend toward sandbagging because, after all, everyone does it, but grouping the discussion of risk tosses out that rationale. Open risk portfolios. Force separate conversations for improvement, growth, and risk. Make risk versus growth decisions at a portfolio level, not within BUs. Tailor approaches on no-regret moves, big bets, and real options. Adjust incentives and measures to reflect the risk people are taking. Force separate conversations. You can move from one integrated strategy review to 3 sequential conversations that focus on the core aspects of the strategy. 1. An improvement plan that frees up resources. 2. A growth plan that consumes resources. And 3. A risk management plan to govern the portfolio. This approach triggers a number of shifts. The shift forces people to discuss growth plans without having to always discuss the however. They can focus on where they can get to and the resources required. So you ask everyone for growth plans, possibly insisting on certain levels to make sure everyone is appropriately imaginative and aggressive. The same with an improvement plan. Only after you've had people put their best ideas on the table do you even begin to discuss risk. The shift forces people to pay a lot of attention to the improvement plans, which often get swept aside by discussions on growth, and which, as we've seen, can produce big moves that lead to strategic success. By letting business leaders put risk explicitly on the table, you change the perception that their heads alone will be on the block if the strategic risk can't be mitigated. They will share what they know of their risks rather than hiding it in their plans or not showing you an initiative at all because the personal risk is deemed to be too high. make risk versus growth trade-offs at a portfolio level. Most importantly, you can now aggregate all proposed initiatives regarding their growth contribution, improvement potential, and inherent risks. It is now possible for you to make decisions on how much risk you want the corporation to take on and to prioritize strategic moves according to a risk-return assessment on a portfolio level. This is a big deal. By separating the conversations, you force people to bring big moves on growth and improvements. You can now ask for audacious plans, say a plus 20 and a plus 40 plan. Then you have the explicit discussion about risk. You pool the risks for all plans, and you prioritize accordingly. You move from local optima with sandbags to a corporate-wide optimum with well-understood risks. You can then also have explicit discussions at the corporate level across all proposed initiatives about macroeconomic or geopolitical risk factors that rarely get explicitly recognized. You can ask, where relevant, for business leaders to submit a minus 20 or a minus 40 plan. Then, you have no choice but to reflect risks that you might be concerned about. Tailor approaches to different risk profiles. Too often we mix up apples and oranges when racking up projects. A no-regret move has known payoffs that work in all scenarios for which standard NPV analysis does the trick perfectly. Often basic efficiency imperatives fit into this bucket. Big bets are high-commitment decisions that have a chance of being wrong. You must make them carefully and apply a lot of scenario analysis and risk management. Real options have lower entry costs, but longer dated and more uncertain payoffs. Because they usually start out of the money, a harsh P&L-only view will kill them, so you will make too little investment in learning and optionality. Be disciplined and deliberate about discussing these different types of risk in different ways. Adjust incentives to reflect risk. This shift, of course, has to translate into performance targets and incentive programs as well. You will have to adjust the targets of leaders who do not get their initiatives approved, perhaps because they would have incurred risks that the company did not want to take. Having a very deliberate management of incentives clears the way for big moves. 7. From "you are your numbers" to a holistic performance view. As hard as all the change will be, there is another complication. Whatever you do, you will not be able to do it alone. You will need to bring your team along. You would not believe how often we see managers being pushed to accept stretch targets, perhaps at least a P50 plan, only 50% chance of being achieved, and how absolutely forgotten these probabilities are when it comes to performance review at year end. People know that they are their numbers, and they react accordingly to attempts to set targets. How can they not? Of course, inviting Mr. Bayes into the strategy room, i.e. bringing probabilities to the fore, can help change the dialogue. Discussing the 1 in 10 and the probabilities of success will change the frame and the perspective of your team. However, you will not get very far beyond a novelty effect if you do not go all the way to aligning incentives and to achieving a real shift in mindset with your team. Unless there is a sense of shared ownership for the fortunes of the company, you will have a hard time getting the full commitment of your team to the big moves required to mobilize your business. A holistic performance view. Encourage noble failures and focus on quality of effort. Reflect higher or lower probabilities of success in your incentive structures. Use team incentives over longer time horizons in riskier contexts. Encourage noble failures. Clearly, understanding the probabilities of success is foundational. You need to have a sense of whether you are accepting a P30, a P50, or a P95 plan. This understanding forms the basis for a reasonable conversation at the end of the year of whether you are looking at a noble failure or a performance failure. Naturally, developing this understanding requires you to dig down on what drove the outcomes, and importantly, not do that just for failures. It's equally important to understand the causes of successes. You don't want to punish noble failures, but you also don't want to reward dumb luck. You want to motivate true quality of effort. At Gore-Tex, for instance, teams get data on performance, and a vote is done on whether the team and its leader did the right thing. This vote is often closer to the truth of what happened than the data themselves. However you improve your understanding of probabilities and use them in incentives, it is crucial for people to understand that they won't be punished simply because a high-risk plan didn't pan out. To beat the odds, you have to overcome the approach that negotiates targets and then ruthlessly applies consequences based on outcomes. If you manage to instill a sense of shared ownership in your team, you will be off to a head start. Reflect probabilities in incentive plans. We aren't suggesting you go to a balanced scorecard, which just opens the field for new social games. Balanced scorecards inevitably create enough opportunities for emphasis that, as a team, you never know what somebody is most focused on delivering. Instead, we propose an unbalanced scorecard. This has two distinct halves. On the left is a common set of rolling financials with a focus on two or three, such as growth and ROI, that connect up to the economic profit goals of the division and enterprise. On the right are a set of strategically relevant initiatives and actions that underpin the plan. Here is how the incentive works. Your economic profit determines a 0 to 100% range for incentives. Then, each of the strategic changes can be a knockout at the discretion of the evaluator. In other words, the way you got the results matters as much as the results. And a knockout is a knockout. Each factor can knock your bonus out, but there is human judgment too. P50 moves will be treated more softly on failure than P90 moves. Could that change the game? It would certainly force a new conversation. Play as a team. Some tasks have short time horizons, have a very obvious link between activity and outcome, are easily monitored, and allow only a small role for luck. In these cases, detailed KPIs with heavy individual incentives probably make sense. But for many other tasks, there can be real problems because of time lags, cooperative effort, and noisy outcomes. That's why foreign exchange traders have very strong individual incentives, but school teachers don't. In particular, if you want good results from a portfolio of moves, you need to encourage enough risk-taking at the individual level so the total risk profile of the portfolio is optimized. As we know, in too many cases, individual risk aversion often prevails and the riskier moves get whittled out, even if they would make the average team performance much better. That's why, as risk goes up, you want individuals to be rewarded based on team performance. Of course, there is a balance because you don't want free riders. You need assurance that the right work is getting done, but in general, if you want more risk to get taken, then put a bigger shared component into individual incentives. 8. From long-range planning to forcing the first step. We see it all the time. Even founders, chairmen, big CEOs, and some of the most impressive business leaders get stuck. They get plans that think big and excite them. They have grand visions of outcomes and performance levels. Industry leadership is presumed, but many of them run into a problem. There is no link between that grand vision and those bold aspirations to a real strategy, no link to the actual big moves that it will take to achieve the vision, and in particular, no link to the first step it takes to get underway in the right direction. It is great to send someone out to achieve a vision, but how do you know what they will do next? Most managers will listen to the visions, develop incremental plans that they deem doable, and execute as well as they can. Often those plans get the company onto a path, but not one that reaches to the vision nor to the full potential of their business. To get to the end of a strategy execution, there has to be a beginning, a first step. That means that after identifying your big moves, you must break them down into proximate goals, missions that are realistically achievable within a meaningful time frame, say 6 to 12 months. Asking the team to wind back goals into smaller, doable steps will not only force the team to get very practical about what to do next, but also give you a roadmap to check whether they are on track to success. Forcing the first step. Put disproportionate focus on the first step when discussing long-term plans. Roll back the future into 6-month increments and set proximate goals around clear operational metrics. At first, focus more on actions than results. Match and mobilize the required resources immediately. Focus on the first step. It's easy to confuse long-range planning with long-range actions. We leave the room with a warm glow about all the things we are going to do one day. But we know the only thing we can really control is what is done now, and this is the sharp point of strategy. Roll back the future. Rather than getting stuck imagining the destination, work back from there and set the milestone markers. Break the journey down into 6-month increments. Then test. Is what I need to do in the first 6 months actually possible? If the first step isn't doable, the rest of the plan is bunk. In the language of strategy professor Richard Rummelt, one of the true arts of strategy is determining the proximate goal. The best thing I can do now with my available capabilities and constraints to advance my strategy. At first, focus more on actions than results. The initial check-in on the plan should be more about whether the first steps have been taken rather than show me the money. Performance conversations focused excessively on financial results put too much emphasis on lagging indicators, a look in the rearview mirror. On the other hand, McKinsey's specialist turnaround and restructuring experts spend a lot more time checking to make sure that actions are taken and milestones reached, and you guessed it, the results follow. Mobilize early resources. You can cascade long-term goals into clear operational metrics and check back on whether initiatives have been given appropriate resources. We cannot tell you how many times we discuss strategic initiatives with clients, such as new growth businesses, but when we ask them about staffing, they say they don't have anybody. You might want to think about organizing a series of agile sprints to get initiatives moving, investing a lot of energy to get things out of the starting blocks. We have shown that big moves are meaningful only if pursued consistently over an extended period. The reason for this 8th and final shift is that every big move starts with a first step. Making sure that resources and people are lined up against the key initiatives is maybe the most important step of all in getting your strategy to beat the odds. An insurance CEO, for instance, worked on a vision with his team, which concluded there would be no paper in the insurance business in 10 years. Plausible, isn't it? When he asked for the annual plan, paper consumption in the next year was set to increase. He then mused to his team, "To connect to our vision, would it be viable to be flat in paper next year and go down the next?" Of course, the team could not say no, and by framing a first step question, the CEO forced the strategy. The package deal. Now, that was a lot of practical advice. Too much? Well, maybe, but we assure you that we have seen it all in motion, and it works. The thing is, these 8 shifts are a package deal. You cannot do some of them and not do others. There is a certain logic to them. Besides, the social side is a beast. You have to go all in and do all of them together, or you open the playing field for new social games. It takes a real intervention to jolt your team into this new frame. How to do it? you will most likely find your very own way of doing it that suits your style, position, team, and business context. But let us illustrate in a simplified example how you might want to think about it. What if you adopted a new strategy process, reserving 10 days a year for conversations and introducing the shifts one meeting at a time? Could that work? If things went wrong, you would go wrong only in one place and could then course correct for the next conversation. Let's presume, for instance, that at the end of the 10 days, you have not been able to free up all the resources you feel are needed. Fine, you take this as a starting point. You take the resources you were able to free up by the end of this first planning cycle and allocate them to the highest priority businesses. That's a start. And more importantly, your team now understands what this new process is all about. That allows you to then increase the level of resources you demand over time. Here is the outline of a 10-day schedule spread over whatever period of time you think would be right. Days 1 and 2. Kickoff meeting to start the journey. Discuss the list of strategic topics you need to address. Discuss the momentum case. Sequence the topics across the other 8 days. Announce the free resources needed for the cycle. Day 3. Describe real alternatives for each strategic topic. Start the debate on direction. Identify the major choices to make. Update the list of strategic topics and discussion sequence. Day 4. Describe alternatives for big moves in each business again. Update the list of strategic topics and discussion sequence. Day 5. Deepen the discussion on priority topics. Follow sequence. Start picking the 1 in 10s. Sort plans into the P50s and the P90s. Take your first votes. Update the list of strategic topics and discussion sequence. Day 6. Deepen the discussion on priority topics. Follow sequence. Describe the big moves for each business. Make the 1 in 10 picks. Update the list of strategic topics and discussion sequence. Day 7. Deepen the discussion on priority topics. Follow sequence. Discuss the big moves as a portfolio of growth initiatives, improvement initiatives, and risks involved. Choose the moves to be pursued with a portfolio view. Update the list of strategic topics and discussion sequence. Days 8 and 9. Deepen the discussion on priority topics. Follow sequence. Translate the plan into unbalanced scorecards. Workshop the key success factors and failure modes and develop mitigation plans. Commit the team. Update the list of strategic topics and discussion sequence. Day 10. Finalize the first steps. Zoom in on details for the first 6 months. Take stock and update the ongoing list of strategic topics and discussion sequence. Celebrate! What do you think? Wouldn't this process be much more real and a lot more fun than the usual hockey sticks and peanut butter business? Epilogue. New life in the strategy room. Are you ready to give big moves a chance? Or does that all sound just a bit too easy? Well, maybe. Strategy remains hard work, and good strategy takes a lot of creativity. Executing strategies requires determined and resilient leadership. Only then do companies have a chance of moving up the power curve. However, in all that we have seen in strategy rooms and boardrooms around the world over our decades of spending time with CEOs, even if you show those three crucial attributes, hard work, new ideas, and resilience, that's not enough. The social side of strategy will likely get in the way. It pulls down good ideas. It produces under-resourced hockey sticks, spreads peanut butter, and leads to disappointing outcomes for everybody involved. You have to turn to the empirics of strategy and have a realistic outside view. Only then can you change the context and have more honest discussions in the strategy room. You can then have the chance to create consensus about strategic decisions that commit to big moves. You are more likely to be fair in terms of the incentives you create for your teams and to differentiate correctly between how much of performance depends on what's happening in the industry and how much credit or blame should go to an individual. You have a chance to create incentives that get everyone to act in the best interests of the corporation and its stakeholders, rather than ultimately just in their own interests. In short, you have a shot at creating a better life and better outcomes for everybody involved.